kind of fasting. It is a kind of self-controlling.
Yes.
In the holy month of Ramadan, what happens is that just we increase some of these self-controlling on eating, for example, on drinking, on sometimes even saying or uttering any words, visiting things, acting. These are the things that we just observe in our life normally. And it is not something very much strange. That's why this self-controlling has lots of benefits.
Mm-hmm.
It empowers us to discover these kind of hidden capabilities of our own selves, that how much strong I am to control, for example, not to visit those things, not to see those things, not to act out those ways, not to utter bad words, you know, not to hear and listen to bad things. So, of course, when you control yourself not to committing bad actions, bad deeds, then, of course, it perfects you.
It gives
you a better life. It helps you to enjoy a better life.
Okay. Thank you much, Sheikh Rouhani. Let's take a break. And after the break, I will come with the second question about the month of Ramadan. It was very kind of you. Dear listeners, taking a break. I'm back in a minute.
IRIB English Radio presents Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Answering your theological questions in Questions and Answers on Islamic Beliefs. Send us your questions to EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. You're listening to the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atta, the host of this program. Sheikh Rouhani is here to answer today's question. Okay, according to so many ahadith and Islamic beliefs, the Satan is chained in the month of Ramadan or imprisoned in the month of Ramadan. So why is it so that if he is chained, some people during Ramadan commit sins?
Yes, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. As you know that Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala always provides us with the opportunities, with the chances to be pure, to stay pure and clean from any kind of, let's say, dirtiness or sins or committing crimes, for example. That is why in this holy month, Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bestows the special kind of his special blessings upon the mu'mineen and the faithful. One is this, that Satan is chained in this holy month and he has no power to deceive and misguide, for example, the people. Those shaitan, they do not have the power to forcefully, let's say, control mankind. Rather, man is with free will, and he freely decides either to follow Satan or not. But in this holy month, a specific or a particular kind of blessing and let's say rahmah and ni'mah of Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is showered on the mu'mineen.
Yes,
and that is why, of course, it helps us better to stay away from committing any sin, any let's say crime in this holy month.
That's right. And is it so that the Satan will be concerned with the believers more in this month because he founds them more powerful in worshipping Allah? I mean, the more powerful the believers are, the more Satan tries to, for example, complicate its traps, isn't it?
Yes, of course. The true mu'mineen and the true faithful people are stronger than the normal people, normal mu'mineen, of course. Then the traps of Satan is more strong for these kind of people. As you rightly mentioned, in this holy month of Ramadan, of course, Satan may try his best to deceive the people in the most, let's say, worst way possible. That's why people should also be very much careful and cautious about this holy month of Ramadan, not to commit sin, not to follow Satan, because Satan tries his best to misguide and deceive people more in this holy month of Ramadan, which is the month of Rahmah and Ni'mah.
That's all right. And as I think you said in one of the episodes of the program that fasting during Ramadan is not only of being hungry and thirsty.
Yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, Satan is going to deceive you through your eyes, ears. What are your practical recommendations in order to be more away from sinning during Ramadan?
The best way is that during the whole year, we must try to be a little bit controlling on ourselves, to control ourselves, to be better controller on our actions or deeds or let's say every kind of sensations that you have. Because what we commit sin are either by hearing, by seeing, by let's say listening, by speaking, by this kind of powers that we have, we commit sin. If we could have control on these things in the whole year, then of course a holy month of Ramadan becomes very much easy, very
yes.
much simple for us.
Yes.
If not, if we do not control ourselves during the other months of the year, then of course fasting becomes a bit kind of difficult for us to observe the rulings of this holy month of Ramadan. That's why I think if someone tries his best to be a bit more controller on himself and the other, let's say, months of the year, then of course he would be more prepared and ready for this holy month to fast.
That's all right. And after the holy month of Ramadan is finished, I mean, the fruits of Ramadan must stay, isn't it? In the
yes,
month
of
Shawwal
yes,
and in the coming months of the year.
Yes.
I mean, we have to re-strengthen the spirit
exactly.
of fasting and Ramadan during the coming month of the year, isn't it, Sheikh?
Exactly. Fasting is not, as you said, fasting is not for only the holy month of Ramadan.
Yes.
It is wajib, obligatory here.
Yes.
But many of these controlling that we do on the holy month of Ramadan, we should continue them. For example, in the holy month of Ramadan, we should not listen to the bad kind of music, haram kind of things. In the holy month of Ramadan, we should not visit and see haram things. We should not drink and eat and taste haram things.
Yes.
We should not perform any other haram kind of things, actions and performance. Same is the case with the other, let's say, months of the year that we must be very much cautious and careful about not doing, not committing all those things anymore in the other months of the year as well. That's why, to some extent, we have kind of fasting in the other months of the year as well, but in this holy month, the specific kind of actions should be
yes.
performed. Yes.
That's all right. Thank you, Shaykh Rouhani, for a nice elaboration. May Allah help us to safeguard our fasting and the spirit of Ramadan during the other months of the year after the month of Ramadan too. And may Allah help us to worship Him in the best way and to be away from satanic temptations during the month of Ramadan. It was very kind of you, Sheikh Rouhani.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban li aliyin wa husaynin wa hasan. Li aliyin wa husaynin wa hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن علي وحسين وحسن.
Welcome to Israel Watch. On this episode, we will monitor carefully the United States' intention to set up a pair in the Gaza Strip, the debate that took place between Biden and Netanyahu, and its interactions with the regime. We will also go over the reality on the ground in Khan Yunis and fears of a sudden surge in the occupied West Bank with the start of the month of Ramadan, as well as the escalation of protests against Netanyahu following his failure to reach a captives exchange deal in light of the disagreements over the draft law on conscription. Regarding these topics, I welcome the researcher in Israeli affairs, Professor Saleh Abu Azza. Welcome, dear Professor. Professor Saleh Abu Azza, what is the Israeli goal of report in the Hebrew media about the presence of the Iranian Red Crescent currently on the ground in Gaza to provide food and medical aid?
This means that the Hebrew media always sheds light on everything that is Iranian, especially since there is always talk about the Islamic Republic and its absolute support for the Palestinian resistance in Gaza. They post no comments if there is any flag other than the flags of the members of the Axis of Resistance, whether it is the Islamic Republic of Iran, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, or Yemen. So at the beginning of the events of October 7th and the start of the Israeli-American aggression on the Gaza Strip, it was officially prohibited. The Israeli side informed the Egyptian side that there should be no entry of any Iranian aid into Gaza. But it seems that the Islamic Republic was able to bring food, medicine, etc. into the Gaza Strip, but not in the proportion that should enter. Meaning, there's still a high percentage of Iranian trucks belonging to the Red Crescent present in Egypt that have not crossed the Rafah crossing until this moment.
As for Netanyahu, who has so far failed to achieve his declared goals of aggression against Gaza, he suddenly announces the assassination of what he calls Hamas's number four, that is, the martyr Saleh al-Arouri, in light of what has been widely promoted in the regime about the possibility of the martyrdom of Commander Maran Issa in an Israeli bombing in Gaza. Professor Saleh Abu Azza, what did Netanyahu want by claiming responsibility for the assassination of Hamas's number four now, at this time, in light of the promotion of allegations by Israeli sources about the possible martyrdom of Commander Marwan Issa in Gaza?
First, there is propaganda practiced by Netanyahu and his team about making achievements against the Palestinian resistance, specifically against Hamas, especially since October 7th. He's been trying hard to eliminate the four leaders, Sinwar, Mohammed Deif, Marwan Issa, and al-Arouri, since the first moments of the aggression, to promote it as an image of victory. But we see that so far, he has only been able to assassinate Sheikh Saleh al-Arouri. But it was kind of by chance, because he didn't mean to, and Sheikh Saleh al-Arouri was actually carrying out part of his activities in an open area. I mean, he was exposed and easy to target. This brings no advantage for Israel.
So what do you think Benjamin Netanyahu wanted?
Now there are doubts about the assassination regarding al-Arouri. Israel usually does not go beyond the borders, especially when it comes to Syria, Iran, or Lebanon. But this time, it has gone beyond and tries hard to present it as a victory for itself, saying that it has finally made an achievement within 6 months. Now, we should note that it is not a matter of days or a round of combat until Netanyahu counts a set of four achievements, profits, and whatever he has achieved. Rather, we're talking about 6 months, and the military achievements are still not clearly visible to the Israeli citizen.
What confirms this is that the occupation forces are still stationed in Khan Yunis, the resistance leaders are still inside the tunnels, and the captives have not yet been released. If the situation continues as it is, there will be no defeat for Hamas. In the same context, analysts in the Hebrew media expressed fear for the occupation soldiers who are now in Khan Yunis with the escalation of resistance operations against them. This assessment was accompanied by speeches by Ehud Olmert, former head of the Zionist regime, in which he called for stopping the aggression against Gaza now, returning the Zionist captives, withdrawing the occupation army, and sending international forces into the Gaza Strip, as happened in southern Lebanon. Dear Professor, I draw attention to Ehud Olmert's words about stopping the aggression, withdrawing from Gaza, and sending international forces, as in southern Lebanon. How do you see this?
In the beginning, the resistance deals with any forces that enter Gaza without the resistance's consent, as they are occupation forces. This has been stated more than once. Even if they are multinational forces led by an Islamic country or another, because there were statements by a number of countries that they wanted to participate in that, so the Palestinian resistance preempted this. It declared that it would deal with any such force that wants to rule Gaza or manage its crossings or elsewhere as an occupying force. Now, in Khan Yunis, they are talking about ending Khan Yunis. We've seen these statements before, by the way. They said that we need a week to finish Khan Yunis. Now they admit that the army has 3.5 months in Khan Yunis. They previously said and promoted that we were able to enter the Al-Tufa neighborhood, the Al-Zaytun neighborhood, and the neighborhoods of the Gaza Strip, in the north of the Gaza Strip. Then it turned out that they would need weeks again to enter the Al-Zaytun neighborhood again. So the resistance has the ability to pull itself together, regain its capabilities, attack again, and carry out operations in the way it deems effective in the reality on the ground. This is what happens on a daily basis. Now there is a strong belief that the Palestinian resistance is exhausting Israel in the entire Gaza Strip.
I mean, it is clear, Mr. Saleh Abu Azza, that the Israeli occupation is enthusiastic about the idea of the sea pair in Gaza. I mean, how does Israel benefit from it, knowing that it is the one waging a war of starvation on the people of Gaza, and now it wants to bring in humanitarian aid? It doesn't make sense.
There are three main parties in this project: the United States, Israel, and the UAE. As for the United States, we find that it wants to present a good image of itself through humanitarian aid and is promoting it, especially in light of the crisis it is suffering from after the Michigan vote and other internal election races. He wants to win the Zionist lobby alongside the community that supports stopping the war on the Gaza Strip by providing this aid and pretending that he wants to distribute 1 million meals on this day, meaning that there is a kind of management of this hunger in a way that serves Biden electorally. When it comes to the Israeli regime, we see that the regime grants this. The pier is a sign that we will have an indefinite period for the continuation of the war. This means that there is a long war still going on, so the international parties must manage the area of hunger in the Gaza Strip in a way that serves the prolongation of this genocide.
The debate that occurred between Biden and Netanyahu recently received the attention of the Hebrew media, which have repeatedly pointed to the American president's statement criticizing the prime minister's Zionist policy and Netanyahu's response to it.
To defend Israel, a right to continue to pursue Hamas, but he must pay more attention to the innocent lives being lost as a consequence of the actions taken. He's hurting, in my view, he's hurting Israel more than helping Israel by. But I'm never going to leave Israel. The defense of Israel is still critical. So there's no red line. I'm going to cut off all weapons so they don't have the Iron Dome to protect them. They don't have. But there's red lines that if it crosses and they cannot have 30,000 more Palestinians dead.
Well, I don't know exactly what the president meant. But if he meant by that, then I'm pursuing private policies against the majority, the wish of the majority of Israelis, and that this is hurting the interests of Israel, then he's wrong on both counts. They support the action that we're taking to destroy the remaining terrorist battalions of Hamas. They say that once we destroy the Hamas, the last thing we should do is put in Gaza, in charge of Gaza, the Palestinian Authority that educates its children towards terrorism and pays for terrorism.
Biden's statements were supported by a wide range of experts and commentators in the Hebrew media who saw that Biden was right in his criticism of Netanyahu, who has burned the regime with Smotrich, as one of them put it. As for what happened, the Israeli media responded to Biden's statements and Netanyahu's response, and here are some of the comments.
Hadar, Netanyahu is a despicable liar and a destroyer of Israel. Most people despise him.
Tami.
Netanyahu, you're living in a movie.
Itai.
This is not the case, and the truth is that most Israelis want to see you in prison.
Ben.
Most Israelis think you are a traitor.
Liad.
The majority are united against you.
Dan.
Netanyahu set an election date, and then we will see what most Israelis think of you.
Israel.
Netanyahu, most Israelis want to see you go to hell.
So, Professor Saleh Abu Azza, what is the background to the goals of Biden's criticism of Netanyahu and the latter's response to him in this way and what we saw, and how will it be reflected in this relationship that exists between the two sides?
The relationship between the United States and Israel is still based on strategic relations that cannot be overcome by differences over this or that issue. Therefore, although this dispute is being promoted in the media and exaggerated intentionally for the sake of Netanyahu, we cannot count on at all, at any moment, as anything other than an internal criticism within the Israeli regime. He always promotes the phrase that he is the most capable of withstanding American pressure and the most capable of withstanding international pressure that pretends to be against the continuation of the war. Now, we notice that the intensity of these public criticisms of Netanyahu has increased in this way after Gantz's visit. It's as if the speech he gave and these statements that Netanyahu made were in fact a response to Gantz's visit and his reception by the U.S. government rather than a response to what Biden says.
Mr. Saleh Abu Azza, specialist in Israeli affairs, thank you very much for participating in this episode of Israel Watch. Thank you for following up, and until we meet again, take care.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means to appoint.
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decree.
His decree, though.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Foresight, and I'm your host, Mehdi. Please stay with us. يا إله كل شيء ومليك يا رب كل شيء وسانع يا خالق كل شيء وورث. Today's tip: what are we learning in the holy month of Ramadan as regards to our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah? Ramadan. So, dear listeners, we are in the holy month of Ramadan. What a beautiful month to be able to witness. May Allah give us the grace and the blessings to be able to witness other holy months of Ramadan in our lifetime, and may we be able to fully benefit from the holy month of Ramadan. So, what are some of the things that we are learning in the holy month of Ramadan when it comes to our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah? So, first and foremost, you know, we are learning to detach ourselves from the very materialistic aspects of ourselves and the materialistic aspects of the world, right? Food and drink is considered to be the most basic materialistic needs that a human being needs, right? And so when we detach ourselves and we break the control of this materialistic variables upon us, then we become free. we are able to fly, if you will, spiritually and metaphysically speaking. And so, first and foremost, in the holy month of Ramadan, we are learning to detach ourselves from these materialistic aspects. Of course, when you detach yourself from the materialistic aspect, you are able to connect to the divine, the spiritual realm, the metaphysical realm. You are able to strengthen your ruh, your spirit or your soul, as it is known in different interpretations. So is this detachment from these materialistic things. And of course, as we have spoken on many occasions on our program regarding ubudiyyah and the worship and the servitude and the obedience to Allah, is that if we are to have a sincere and pure ubudiyyah, then one of the integral aspects is that we have to cut ourselves from the materialistic chains that hold us down. We cannot really involve ourselves in a pure form of ubudiyyah if we are attached to the materialistic realm and the materialistic variables. Now, this is not just limited to food and drink. Of course, food and drink is the most basic and perhaps the strongest and the most necessary of all of these materialistic aspects. But, you know, the other, you know, variables and the other branches of these materialistic aspects, you know, wealth and power and money and women and clothes and jewelry, I don't know, cars and mansions and shoes and watches and all these kind of different things, these are different manifestations of these materialistic aspects which we are trying to rid ourselves from and detach ourselves from in the holy month of Ramadan. And so when we realize that we are able to detach ourselves from one of the strongest materialistic aspects of our being, food and drink, then these other materialistic aspects are much easier for us to detach ourselves from.
Ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Allah, ya Mannan,
IRIB English Radio.
Our website is parstoday.ir.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
This question comes up, especially when we talk to those who have never heard about Islam, don't know much about Muslims. And when you say that we have to fast for 30 days in the month of Ramadan, from dawn to dusk, not even allowed to drink water, for them it's a very difficult issue to digest. And they say, you know, why do you go through hunger and thirst for 30 days? Why do you go through this struggle and hardship or suffering? The reasons can be given of different kinds. You know, if you just look at the benefits which have been described from different dimensions, just recently, this month of June, on the 5th of June, there was a report from the scientists of the University of South California. But after their observation and research, there was a very interesting statement where they said, fasting for as little as 3 days can generate the entire immune system, even among the elderly ones. Now remember, 3 days minimum fasting. It's interesting that when we look at many of the sunnah fasts that we have, besides the month of Ramadan, you know, 13th, 14th, 15th, or Laylatul Raghaib is again 3 days. Many other nazar that people do is 3 days. And it's interesting that, you know, the scientists there, they say this regenerates the immune system, even among elderly. They further said that the discovery could be particularly beneficial for people suffering from damaged immune system, such as cancer patients who are on chemotherapy. And so, yes, there is a medical benefit to fasting, no doubt about it. On social level, you know, this is an opportunity of helping those who are less fortunate in the society. The issue of fitrah is actually a sign of that. Because when we are hungry and thirsty, we can relate more to the poor and the needy in the community. According to our ahadith, one of the benefits of fasting is that the gap between the rich and poor is reduced. Not totally, but it is brought closer.
Through the skies, waiting for our old friend. With loved ones nearby and our spirits high, a blessed time we'll spend. In both love and in fear, to Allah we draw near, hands raised to the sky. Oh Allah, please forgive us and guide us to paradise. Ramadan is here, Allah's mercy is near. Time to give, time to share, time to show we care, 'cause Ramadan is here.
Welcome back to your listeners. This is Foresight on IRIB English Radio. So we're talking about some of the things that we are learning in the holy month of Ramadan. And of course, these are things which we should continue throughout the year. And, you know, perhaps it's not a bad idea to have a little notebook handy and write some of these things, you know, in the notebook that we are learning in the holy month of Ramadan that we would like to continue on through the rest of the year. So the first thing which we learned and we are learning in the holy month of Ramadan, of course, is this detachment from the materialistic aspects of ourselves and the materialistic aspects of the world. This is really one major thing that we are learning, and it is directly connected to ubudiyya, because true ubudiyya, this pure, sincere form of worship and servitude and obedience to Allah, can only come about with a detachment from these materialistic things which take us away from the love of the Almighty Allah. Of course, another one of the things that we learn in the holy month of Ramadan is how strong we are. Of course, refraining from food and drink and going about our daily activities as routine while fasting. So going to school, going to work while fasting, these all really show this great power and this untapped potential that every single one of us as a human being has. And the holy month of Ramadan really shows us this, that we are able to involve ourselves in and conduct and perform this very high level of ubudiyya and this high level of worship, servitude, and obedience to Allah. A lot of times we don't understand how profound the essence of fasting is and how valuable it is. We kind of, you know, take it with a grain of salt, but in reality, fasting, especially in the holy month of Ramadan, is considered to be perhaps one of the ultimate peaks and the ultimate summit of the ubudiyya and the worship and the servitude and the obedience to the Almighty Allah. It is something that is definitely very honored, it is very blessed, it is very righteous, it is very noble. And as Allah says, that the reward is Allah for this fasting. One last thing before we run out of time on the program that we learn in the holy month of Ramadan as regards to our ubudiyya is this idea that we establish a connection and a relationship with the Almighty Allah. This is one of the fundamental things that is trying to be achieved in this holy month of Ramadan. right? Not eating, not drinking, detaching ourselves from our materialistic aspect, detaching ourselves from the materialistic world and its various variables, increasing our spiritual strength, purifying our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, our obedience to Allah, and performing a ubudiyya and performing a worship and servitude to Allah in the form of fasting in this very holy month. All of these things and the other things that, you know, are being done in this holy month is for us to be able to establish a connection with the Almighty Allah. That is the ultimate purpose, and that is something which, inshallah, we hope to continue in our ubudiyya, our worship, our servitude, and our obedience to Allah in the rest of the year, and inshallah, in the rest of our lives. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until another episode and another great tip, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
رمضان هل هلاله فاستبشروا بطلوعه وبصومه وصلاته وبذكره وخشوعه فاضت علينا رحمة بالخير من ينبوعه قد عاد يشرق بالهدى يا مرحبا برجوعه
رمضان أقبل بالمسرة بعد طول مغيبه رمضان أقبل والأحبة بشروا بقدوم.
Everyone has a beloved, a new dear friend. But I have you, my dear. May God protect you, my dear. May God protect you.
IRIB English Radio, for those who seek the truth.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Welcome to IRIB English Radio, where we explore the Islamic upbringing of children and teenagers, guided by the wisdom of the Quran and the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt. Today, we are honored to have Sister Salma Khalfan, a distinguished Islamic researcher, with us to shed light on this important subject. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Salma. Thank you for joining us today.
Alaykum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thank you so much for having me over.
Thank you so much for being here. So in the previous episode, we were talking about why it's important for a teenager to talk about their feelings. And you gave some very practical tips, because you say that teenagers tend to bottle up. And, you know, when they express themselves, they are able to clear up their mind. And the parents are, you know, they're are the best supporters. And because there are times where teenagers can be very aloof and isolating, but if you try and relate to them, try and converse with them, they will open up to you. So this is very necessary. So do you want to say more about this?
Yeah. I must add that, when a teenager tries to now be verbal and express their emotions, they may find some new channels coming up, like common interests between parent and a child. So it's very important to have this conversation of expressing their feelings. And time and again, the parent should also, you know, comment on how they feel.
Yeah.
So that feeling, when it's let out, the parent should know that so-and-so is like with this kind of a build character. The personality is this way, maybe sensitive or maybe a bit like too much easygoing or things like that. So common interests are very important between the parent and child or who you're talking to. The more you express yourself, your feelings, you'll know that even you feel the same way, or even you don't, or maybe you don't feel the same way. So if you feel the same way, that's an ideal situation. If, for example, somebody, mostly we as human beings feel bad when somebody, you know, like ignores us or something like
true,
that. Yeah?
Yeah.
So if, for example, a teenager is facing, girls are more emotional, so they may face this kind of problem of people ignoring them in school, or the teacher. That's a very bad situation, but the teacher sometimes ignores the child.
That's difficult.
You know, here I am reminded of a very interesting incident that there was a girl in my family, and she was also facing a problem with the teacher. But why? Is because she was super intelligent, but she couldn't shake hands with the teacher.
Yeah.
So when she related that, everybody teased her in class, because of course she was observing the hijab as a young girl of maybe 13-14, but mashallah, she was observing hijab. So in a country where, you know, hijab was not necessary, she didn't shake hands, and the teacher was so, like, he got so temperamental that he threw the paper. And here, when she confided, then there was such a common interest of, you know, this observing the wajibat and religiosity. And it's such a bond formed here when the parent shows that, you know, he's proud. She's proud of that. So see, the common interests come out in every kind of thing. When we express our feelings, common interests come out. Or, for example, like talking about a person and feeling that why they ignored me. So this interest also, the common interest is here, that maybe the parent also feels the same way. And then they should come up with a solution. That is it like worthwhile to do this? Let's think of a solution. And also asking them for some advice in the process. That would make them feel that, you know, they're important.
Very true. I feel like when a bond is formed between a mother and son or daughter, it's a very beautiful moment, because it doesn't happen too often. You know, they feel like, oh no, this is my own space, you don't have to, you know, get inside. Let's just take a short break and we'll continue shortly.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we have been discussing about a very important aspect of teenagers, whereby we are trying to say that it's important for a teenager to talk about their feelings. And you mentioned in your last point that You know, when a teenager starts to open up, that's when they realize that they have things in common with their parents, with their family, and which is so important. It really opens doors.
That's right. Another factor is that teenagers who talk about their feelings lay the foundation for effective communication in adulthood.
Yeah.
So when they know how to relate themselves so well, when they become adults, they would know also how to relate themselves so well with their own partners and their children. They would be able to do such a good tarbiyat of their child also. You know, so this is healthy emotional well-being. Emotional well-being is very important, that how you relate to your emotions. Do you know how to deal with them? It's very important to know how to deal with your emotions.
True.
If you just bottle up, that's not a good way to deal with them. If you resort to another thing like overeating or, you know, resorting to other things, watching movies or just passing your time with play, it's still at the back of your mind. But if you come out and, solve the problem, then it'll be out of your mind. You'll have solved it and you'll know how to, you'll have a healthy emotional well-being when you're an adult. And you can relate also the same way with your family. So this is like building the blocks, you know, building the foundation to encourage this kind of expression of your emotional feelings from a teenager towards his parents. Like the teenager should confide with the parents so that to have the emotional well-being.
True. I think many times when we talk to other people, they usually bring about their childhood or their teenagehood where they kind of bring out that had a really big impact, or because they did a certain thing at that age, it really helped them in their life at the moment.
Yeah.
Or something really, you know, had a big impact on them. So it's, like you said, it's very true. You know, a lot of things really play a big impact if done correctly or incorrectly during this teenage age.
And then also, you know, it could recur.
Mm-hmm.
So when it recurs, it's always the parent to solve. If the parent is very clever enough to solve and to see what feelings they're going through and to guide and support them, then they would know that the best solution is to go towards the parents.
Mm.
Not that, you know, you probably, you know, like shun them or not lay emphasis on their problem or just feel that, you don't have time for them, make them feel that you don't have time for them, take it lightly or, you know, advise them or lecture them, nag them. You know, complain about their attitude. No, it's really giving these all factors importance so that they can know, now I have somebody to turn to.
Yeah.
I know I can trust fully my parent, my mother, my father, whoever it be. But it must be an elder and in the family so that one can know what's going on with the life of your teenage child. Yeah. So as I said, healthy emotional well-being is very important. Another last but not least final point is that, you know, feelings can help identify that if there is anxiety or depression in a person or other mental health issues, you know, that if a person gets timely support, then they will be free from this kind of anxieties and mental and health issues.
True.
You know, sometimes if you are so anxious about something or you bottle up your feelings, you can probably have a very bad stomach pain or a headache or migraine or even depression. Like, you know, sometimes the chemical balance of the brain becomes low out of thinking so much that it reaches the peak.
Yeah.
Then it goes low. And then you have to get antidepressants or other kinds of drugs that are not, you know, good for that. And they say that tears are so important, like crying over when you feel emotional and you feel that, you know, your child wants to cry, give them a shoulder to cry on and tell them it's okay to cry.
Yeah, definitely.
So that they can release those tears, because those tears are so good as a painkiller, an emotional painkiller, so that they cannot resort to antidepressants and, you know, drugs to make them sleep and forget and things like that.
True.
So it's very important to...
It really softens the
heart. Yeah, exactly.
Opens room to, like, other understandings.
To feel better, to feel, you know, that motivation coming back.
Definitely. So let's just take a small break and we're going to continue shortly.
يَا مُقْيَ الْخَيْرَاتِ يا مقضي الخيرات يا مقضي الخيرات.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alihi wa sallam said, honor your children and teach them good manners.
يا مقضي الخيرات.
الخيرات يا مطي الخيرات.
Welcome back to IRIB English Radio, where we had been discussing about why it's important for a teenager to talk about their feelings, and we got some very good points from that. So we have another question. What role does religion of Islam play in shaping the personality of our youth and teenagers?
That's a beautiful question, and it would be a lot of things we could discuss about, but I'll inshallah just talk about the main things. And first of all, I want to explain what personality itself means. And personality is a combination of characteristics or qualities that form an individual's distinctive character. What's the distinctive character? For example, a person may have so many characteristics, but they say that he's a sunny personality. Sunny means like the sunshine. Why? Because they're very engaging, very, you know, like full of laughter, full of happiness, like the sun shining. How?
True, yeah.
That's how the sunny personality. Or his personality is like, is a moody personality. Always he will, you know, like, that's the standing out character, the distinctive character among all the things, because of the pattern that goes on and on in life, the way you're brought up, your hereditary and the family that you were brought up in, and the way that you were, you know, like given tarbiyah and everything. So that it means like you come up with that kind of personality. So it refers to the enduring characteristics and behavior that comprises a person's unique adjustment to life. Like, for example, the major traits, the interests, the values that a person has, the self-concept that he believes in himself, the abilities he has, and the emotional patterns he has.
That's very interesting.
Yeah, all these form a personality. So, although I don't want to discuss, but it's interesting here to say that in Arabic, like Quran also talks about shakila.
Yeah.
You know, everybody has a different shakila. It means individuality. Mm-hmm. That it makes a person unique from the other. And everyone in life is unique from the other. Nobody can be completely the same. So, basically, it's some Muslim linguistics say that it's the qualities that distinguish one person from the other, or the personality in its broad meaning is the total quality of an individual's behavior. The youth and adolescent and teenage age is undoubtedly a very ripe time to shape this personality. You know, some psychologists also say that at the age of 3, the personality of a child is completely set. But no, here we say that it's the adolescent and the youth age is the ripe time to shape the personality. Inshallah, in our next program, we'll go on more about that.
Inshallah, thank you very much. And thank you so much for your valuable time, and we hope to see you in the next episode. And dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. You've just listened to IRIB English Radio, where we had a discussion on child upbringing. And if you want to listen to our programs or get more information, you can log on to parstoday.ir/en under the tab COI, Call of Islam. And if you type in Call of Islam Radio, you can find it on YouTube and Instagram. And you can email us on englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, God bless you all.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
How many more children?
Gaza, October 7th. The sun is coming up. Boats are moving up and down in the cool sea breeze. Seagulls flying over the beach. The law before the storm. Suddenly, a bulldozer breaks the Israeli-built fence around Gaza. No one really knows what is happening.
In no time, fighters from Gaza take control of the Beit Hanun crossing. A land, air, and sea attack into the heart of Israeli-occupied territories. Palestinian forces attack military installations and take over various settlements. The Israelis in the Sharon Plain wake up to the blare of sirens. They're caught off guard. Danger is around the corner. They don't expect their holiday to be ruined like that. Israel describes the operation as an unprovoked attack, blaming Hamas for disturbing the peace in the region. In the United States, politicians echo the same narrative. Former U.S. President George W. Bush calls Hamas cold-blooded killers.
This was an unprovoked attack by terrorist people willing to kill innocent people to achieve an objective. And don't be surprised if Israel takes whatever action is necessary to defend herself. And it's going to be ugly for a while. You're dealing with cold-blooded killers.
But is the Palestinian group's operation really an unprovoked attack? And isn't there anything surprising about it?
Let me show you a map of the Middle East.
Just a couple of weeks before Hamas launched Operation Al-Aqsa Flood, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu had unveiled his future map of the region at the United Nations General Assembly. The map had no place for Palestinians, and Israel still included the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip, as well as the occupied and illegally annexed Golan Heights of Syria. The little map was in fact the blueprint for the complete elimination of Palestine from the region for the sake of the so-called Greater Israel. Israel's prolonged policy of ignoring Palestinians' rights as a nation is clearly reflected in its illegal settlement projects. Built on usurped territories, these settlements and their cancerous expansion have dashed Palestinians' hopes for establishing their own state and ending their lingering limbo as a nation under occupation. In recent years, the Israeli regime has put settlement expansion at the top of its priorities. In one of the recent cases, Netanyahu passed a controversial resolution in June 2023 and gave a carte blanche to his cabinet to construct more settlements in the occupied West Bank. One month later, the head of the Regional Council for West Bank Settlements, Yossi Dagan, submitted a proposal to Netanyahu to increase the number of Jewish settlers in the northern West Bank from 170,000 to 1 million by 2050. There are already over 700,000 Israeli settlers living in 176 settlements and 186 so-called outposts in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds. All of these settlements and outposts and the settlers who live in them are illegal under international law. Since occupying the West Bank and Gaza, Israel has unilaterally declared tens of thousands of hectares of a so-called state land for Israeli settlements. Mushrooming across Palestine, these illegal settlements have